Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
So much of this work and so much of my mission, it's about... it's like midwifery, right? And being able to pull out of individuals what they can't push out on their own, right? And I tell this story. I have four children, and I was there for the delivery of all four of my children. And my final born child, I had twin boys, Cameron and Caleb. And Caleb, in the delivery room, his twin brother came out, Cameron. And no matter how hard my wife, Desiree, pushed, Caleb would not come out. I was like, what's happening? She done already pushed out four babies in her lifetime. And Caleb was breached. He was turned around. You know, babies come out head first. And they weren't ready for a C-section. And 9 minutes after his twin brother Cameron was born, Caleb's vital signs were beginning to drop. And the doctor said, I have to go in and pull him out, right? And pulled Caleb out by his feet. And so many of us leaders who have pushed out great things, but the thing that we are called to really push out that is going to make a transformational impact in the world, we will never push out alone.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Sean, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Srini, thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. And I am very delighted to learn that you've actually been a longtime listener, which I didn't know, but I actually found out about your work through two of our former guests, Chris Wilson and TK Coleman. And we will get into all of that. But I was so intrigued by what you're up to. I thought you were doing a lot of really amazing work in the world. And I think that given the nature of your work, I think this is a very fitting question to start with. And that is, where in the world did you grow up, and what impact did where you grew up end up having on the choices that you've made throughout your life and your career and the work that you're doing today?
So I'm a native New Yorker. I've lived in every borough except for Staten Island, and spent most of my formative years in Harlem and on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Raised by a single mom, strong Jamaican woman, Deanna. And she just exposed me to a great deal, right? And so I think, you know, traveling through all of the boroughs, I've had a lot of exploration, and my life has just been one of so many dualities, right, and dichotomies. Living in Harlem and essentially, you know, being around just all Black people, right, and then moving down to the Upper West Side and it being mixed and more diverse. And so I think it's allowed me to navigate different worlds. And I like to say, I think I can effectively navigate both the boardroom and the block, City Hall, and the corner. And a lot of that has to do with just my upbringing and just traveling and surviving and thriving in different circles.
Yeah. You grew up with a single mom. You know, obviously, I don't have any idea what that is like, but what misperceptions do you think that people have about that? What do you think the impact has been of not having had a father figure in your life? And just out of curiosity, have you ever connected with your father? Do you know anything about him? These are the things that just I'm very curious about, because it seems like such a different experience. And then the other question is, so often when children are raised by a single parent, that ends up having an incredibly detrimental effect on their life. And you seem to have transcended that in very big ways. I know, because I've read your about page. I mean, you went to Columbia, you know, you seem to have overcome what would typically be an environment that could actually hold somebody back.
So that's really interesting. You know, I think narrative is just a powerful thing, and perception. And I do think, and particularly in the African-American community, right, there's this perception of if you are raised by a single mom, that is a life of a squalor and hardship and a difficulty. And so quite the contrary. My mother, who is, I guess, the first entrepreneur and creative in my life, was very resilient and resourceful. And what was interesting is that early on, she found someone that took care of children, right? So we were living in the South Bronx, and she found this woman, Lillian Smith, who took care of other kids, right? And Lillian, we called her Lel, was a classic big mama matriarch. In the community. And we grew up on 119th Street and Lenox Avenue. And so during the week, I was in Harlem, and on the weekends with my my mother. And, you know, this sense of community is really important in building community. And while I did not grow up with my father, I was very close to his parents. So my grandmother and grandfather on his side, they would, you know, they grew up, they lived in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, and they would pick me up, and I would spend weekends with them. And so I never woke up one day to say, good morning, Dad. You know, my father wasn't in my life. We eventually developed a relationship, and it was more of a intersection than being intertwined, I would say. But I think it's really important for folks to understand, just because someone is raised by a single mom, that does not, in some cases, that's an asset, right? Looking at my story from behind, you know, backwards, I think it was an asset that I was raised by a single mom, and the resourcefulness that she had. And what's really interesting, I'm an only child, right? I do have a half brother and half sister. My father eventually, he did get married and had twins. And what was really interesting, I had this duality of both being a single only child, but growing up with Lel during the week, she took care of a bunch of other kids, right? There's this movie out there, I don't know if you've ever seen it, called Lackawanna Blues by Hill Harper. And he grew up in this boarding house, and Lel had a bunch of boarders. And she also ran numbers. And Srini, I don't know if you're familiar with the numbers system, but it was an underground economy in the African-American community where, like today, there's the Lotto and the Powerball and the Mega Millions. In the African-American communities across the country, there was the numbers. And she ran numbers, Lel, who was my godmother, with the father of a notorious Harlem a drug lord by the name of Nicky Barnes, and so his father, Roy Barnes. And so there was a lot of activity and a lot of folks coming in and out of the house, the boarders, one boarder, you know, lots of stories and characters. Mr. Archie, who also lived in the apartment. This is one of these old Harlem apartments. There were like seven rooms in the apartment. He was from Barbados. He was a Bajan. And Mr. Archie's story was, no matter what the number was that day, whatever those three numbers were, when Mr. Archie came home, if it was 475, you can guarantee Mr. Archie was going to say in his Bajan dialect, 475, I was going to play that number. And so I had a very rich and robust childhood. Yes, all around me there were drugs. There was violence. But there was still a sense of growing up in the 70s and, you know, late 60s in Harlem, a sense of community. And that if I did something a block away on the corner of 119th Street and 7th Avenue, there was a sense of ownership and community. And, you know, the adults knew who I was. Oh, that's one of Lel's kids, right? And so if I got in trouble and I was doing something I wasn't supposed to do, adults in the community felt a sense of ownership and they would reprimand you. And by the time I got a block away to where I lived, and this was long before a text or a DM or social media, word traveled, right? And so I got reprimanded outside. And when I got home, I got reprimanded. You know, I tease and say that, you know, I have a PhD from UCLA. And UCLA, for those that know Harlem, is the university on the corner of Lenox, Lenox Avenue. And so my mother just has had an powerful impact. She's taught me sacrifice. We moved together full time at fifth grade when we moved down to the Upper West Side. And, you know, one of the things, it was a one bedroom apartment. And she gave me, you know, her 12-year-old son, the bedroom, and she slept on the pull-out couch, and just saw her be resourceful. And so I think it's really important that folks don't misunderstand that just because someone has a single parent, that is a negative or detriment.
Yeah. So I mean, I think the interesting thing is you mentioned that you you know, were around an environment where there were drugs, there were violence. And I imagine that there are probably people who I come from, you know, the neighborhoods that you grew up in that ended up on a very different path. And so there are two questions that come from that. You mentioned that your mother is Jamaican. Was she first generation? And if so, I wonder, you know, what impact being an immigrant had on the way that she went about raising you? Because I think that when you grew up in an Indian family, particularly, you know, our parents, like, we're probably semi-close in age based on kind of what you're telling me. And my parents came here and they had nothing. It was literally, we're starting from scratch. And they had a very clear way of sort of educating us and making us go through the world, which was, you're going to be upstanding citizens of society. If we have anything to do with it, you're going to be, you know, more than that. And so I wonder, yeah, you know, about the immigrant aspect of it, but also then, you know, why do you get somebody who ends up, you know, the way that you do, despite being in a neighborhood like that? And then why do we have somebody like Chris Wilson? Who comes from a neighborhood like that?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that there's a Chris Wilson inside of me, right? There's a part of my Chris Wilson story is my story, not to the extreme. I was never incarcerated, but got caught up in the drug culture. And, you know, this September, I'll have 30 years clean without a drink or a drug. But, growing up where I grew up, it was almost hard to escape those challenges, right? And I was just fortunate and blessed that my story didn't turn out exactly like Chris Wilson's story. So it was not like I was unscathed, right? So, but I think the point about the immigrant family and my mother coming from Jamaica, and what was interesting is that her mother came here first, and then my mother came to the States. And my mother's very independent. She was a flower child, hippie type, very independent. But education was paramount, and she just instilled that in me. And one of my memories of growing up is that my mother always had books around the house, right? They were like to the ceiling high bookshelves, and I was just surrounded by books. And I remember, you know, picking books off of the bookshelf and looking in my early adolescence and looking for the steamy sex scenes in the book. But this love of reading was always there. And when you think about education and decisions, you know, a transformational moment and decision that my mother made, right? So when I moved down to the Upper West Side, I went to this middle school called IS 44, which is right across the street from the Museum of Natural History, right? And transferred from a school in Harlem that was all Black to a diverse school, Asians and white kids. And after sixth grade in IS 44, you had to make a choice between major math and science or major gym. Yes, major gym. And I remember when the permission slips came home, because all of my friends and all of my homeboys were like, yeah, we're going to major gym, playing sock hockey tournaments and all of that. And I remember coming home and giving my mother the permission slip for me to for 7th and 8th grade to be in major gym. And she looked at me and said, you have got to be out of your mind. There is no way you're going to major gym. And you're going to major math and science, right? And so for 2 years, I had a big resentment with my mother, because all of my friends, and we talk about racial equity, the dynamic was most of the Black and Latino students were in major gym. Most of the Asian and white students were in major math science. It was just amazing how this turned out, right? And, you know, a lot of it not by accident. And so while I was dissecting frogs and messing with a Bunsen burner, my friends, and this was like on the same floor, but different ends of the hall, right? Different qualities of teaching. And I had a resentment, you know, that, you know, I couldn't hang out with my friends. And then when it was time to graduate and go on to high school, all the students from major math and science were going to specialized high schools in New York City, like Stuyvesant and Bronx Science and Brooklyn Tech. I went to Brooklyn Tech. I thought I wanted to be an architect. And I had to actually go to summer school because I missed the exam by 1 point to get in. And all of the students from major gym were going to the neighborhood high schools. And many of them turned out fine or have lived successful lives, but the chances and the exposure, and I saw that, God, in retrospect, there was a track in then. But that was a decision that my mother made, right? Because if it was up to me, I would have been in major gym. And there's so many decisions like that, Srini, over my life that others have made. And I've just been blessed to have an amazing cohort of mentors and people that saw something in me before I saw something in myself. And so education was really independent. My mother was a risk taker, and she exposed me to a lot. Every summer, starting at 6 years old, I was shipped off to a summer camp, the Fresh Air Fund, and was exposed to different things. And, you know, when I was in my junior year of high school, I was involved in this youth program called the Dome Project on the Upper West Side, which had just an amazing change in my life, the trajectory of change in my life. And my mother allowed me to, during my spring break, do a project and take a bus from New York to California to visit youth programs in California. And by bus, me and another young man went, and other parents were like, you're allowing your son to go across country on a bus? And my mother was like, yes, you know, it's going to be great exposure. And so it was things like that, the risk taking, that I think I inherited as well. You know, there's one other thing I wanted to say about my mother, is that my mother and father, who were never married, but they were both dancers. And that's how they met, right? And that's how I was conceived. And my mother was a great dancer, and she was also a great seamstress, right? And for a time, she made my clothes. You know, I have pictures of, you know, so when I grew up, I had a big afro like Michael Jackson, and she would make my clothes. I have pictures of me in a powder blue jumpsuit that I won't post because it would be very, I would be ridiculed. And
damn it, I was going to ask you to let us use that as your album cover for the Unmistakable.
But the thing about it, what she did was, and I learned to sacrifice, as I shared earlier, how she slept on the pullout couch in the living room and gave me the bedroom. My mother decided to not pursue her artistic talents and passions and gifts in order to raise me and to work She wound up working 30 years for the federal government, and she sacrificed a lot for me, right? And sometimes, or too often, parents don't do that, right? And so I thank my mother every day for that. And I just recently had my 35th college reunion at Wesleyan University. I didn't go. I couldn't go, but they provided me with a service award just for my, you know, the work that I've done since graduating. And, you know, and I sent that to her and said, you know what, I'm not putting this on my wall, you know, on my wall, right? This belongs to you. And there's just so many things that I've done over my career. If it were not for her and my mentors and this whole sense of community around me, never would have happened.
Wow. So many more questions. So, you know, I think that one of the things that I noticed when I was looking at your website was you talk about this idea of, you know, giving a voice to people who have been marginalized. And we'll actually get into what your work is about. But I want to talk about this idea of being marginalized and how you define marginalized, what it means. And you know, what does a person who comes from a place of privilege not really understand what it means to be marginalized? Because I think that, you know, at this point, you know, Sean, both of us are living lives of privilege. I mean, you're a graduate from Wesleyan and Columbia. I went to Berkeley and I have a Pepperdine MBA. We'd be kidding ourselves if we lied about the fact that we are approaching this life with a level of privilege that other people don't have and may never have access to. And, you know, part of why this particular, that definition of marginalized came up for me is because of, you know, I think you, my guess is you've probably already seen it since it's in the news, the documentary or the film about the Central Park Five. You probably grew up around that time, right?
Yes, indeed. I lived like four blocks away. I live in Towers on the Park on 110th and Frederick Douglass Avenue. And the young men, they lived four blocks away on Fifth Avenue in Schomburg Towers. And yes, I remember that in 1989 when it happened. And so Ava just did a marvelous job telling and giving life to their stories. And so when we talk about privilege and when we talk about marginalization, you know, we have to go to the roots of this country and the founding fathers and in a sense, the schizophrenia that this country is based on, right? And on one hand, values of the land of the free and the brave and the pursuit of happiness on one hand. And but in the other hand, the country built on the legacy of slavery and white supremacy and the spreading of an ideology that one race and color is better than the other, right? And so when we talk about marginalization today in 2019, we certainly have to put it in the context of the last 400 years of this nation. And I certainly believe that there are levels of privilege, right? Mm-hmm. And I certainly, and that's when I have five questions that I ask the leaders that I'm associated with, right? And one of those questions is, you know, what are you doing about your privilege, right? And yes, I do have a certain level of privilege, being a man, being a black man, graduating from my institution, like, Wesleyan University. But if I'm pulled over, by police officers, there is nothing that is flashing on my forehead that is a scorecard of that privilege, right? Right. That privilege goes out the window dependent on the context. And I just think that this nation and we're just like still has to reconcile its roots, right? Mm-hmm. Its roots of violence and slavery, and that continues today. And so there are so many policies and structures and systems that ensure that poor people, right, and many of whom people of color stay poor and stay marginalized, right? And so I think that that's why I have this inner compass of doing the work that I do, leading the campaign for Black male achievement. And, you know, one of our mission mantras is that, you know, there's no cavalry coming to save the day in our communities, that we're the iconic leaders that we've been waiting for, the curators of the change that we're seeking to see. And what I have seen in my career, what I've seen in myself, adversity has become an asset, right? And being able to bounce back from racism and being able to do that as an individual is one thing, but being able to do it as a people is a fight that we are still engaged in. And yeah. One of the things that I think is really important when I say, you know, we're the iconic leaders that we are waiting for, the most marginalized people in not only this nation, in the world, just have, I believe we all have genius, right? And that we all have a brilliance. And the resiliency that I have witnessed, despite the structures and the systems and the racism of particularly Black people and Black people in America, is phenomenal, and it's inspiring, right? And so one thing is, and I've done this through my career, is certainly being an advocate and a champion and lifting barriers and creating platforms of opportunity for marginalized populations. But even more so than that is providing the relationships and resources for folks to become champions of change for themselves. You know, there's this mm-hmm. whole notion called the power of positive deviance. And what the power of positive deviance lets us know is that the solution to the world's most intractable problems resides in the hands, the heads, and the hearts of those that are experiencing the oppression, right? And I've spent part of my career in philanthropy, and sometimes in philanthropy, we take on the persona that we are paratrooping into communities with prescriptions and solutions. And the truth of the matter is that the solutions and the prescriptions for change resides in those communities already, right? And so there's this whole notion, and Brian Stevenson talks about this a lot, right? He was on the board of directors when I was at the Open Society Foundation, this power of proximity, and that the folks that are closest to the issues and the problems are the ones with the most innovative solutions, right? But resources are really important. And we talk about marginalization, that we're talking about political marginalization and education and social, but economic mobility and access to resources, and looking at America's wealth gap is really important when we have this conversation.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, you know, so there's so many things that I want to ask you about this. You may have heard the conversation that I had with Desiree Attaway, where we were talking about the intersections of race, class, culture, and gender. And we were talking about, you know, how each of us defines racism. And I think, you know, one of the things I said is it reminds me of this moment when I went to the Museum of Tolerance in LA, where they have two doors. And one door says that if you don't have any biases, walk through this door. If you do, walk through this door. And the one that basically says if you don't have any biases, walk through this door is locked. It doesn't open, which is a really interesting metaphor. And I mentioned this to her, like what was, you know, even growing up, you know, my parents are far from racist, but there was almost this, like, you know, there's like among Indian people we're kind of like, okay, the litmus test of your parents' racism is bring home a black girl or a Muslim girl, and you'll figure out how racist or how tolerant your Indian parents really are. Those are our two extremes for them. Like literally you're kind of like, I could bring anybody home, but that would be kind of a litmus test. Despite how open-minded they claim to be. And so I wonder, you know, when you were young and also as you've gotten older, what were your first experiences with racism? How did you define it? And how has that changed with age? And, you know, don't you think it's a little insane that 200-300 years after this country is formed, we're still having this conversation?
Well, yes, I do think it's insane. But I think that just the construct of racism is, I think, based in an ideology of insanity to think that a class and color of people are superior than another a race of people, right? I think, you know, genetically we have more in common than we have differences. Yeah. And what was really interesting about my upbringing was that, you know, I was exposed to, and I talked about this dichotomy, this different, you know, and I think my mother was really intentional about this, right? And so while going to grade school all the way to fifth grade, you know, my classes and most of the teachers were all black, right? But when I went to summer camp, it was mixed. And I would say that the, you know, race was always an issue, right? But it was a source of pride and you know, growing up. And Muhammad Ali was my first hero. And seeing a black man say that I'm fast, I'm pretty, and I can't possibly be beat, and to be bold as he was gave me a sense of pride. I was very young. I was just 6 years old, or going on 6 years old. But I remember in Harlem the riots and uprising after Martin Luther King was assassinated, right? And that memory sticks in my head, where there was a Woolworths on 116th Street and Lenox Avenue, and being able to look out the window and seeing people running in and out of the Woolworths, right? And so I don't think that it's insane to still be having this conversation today, because I think that we live in a system that is designed to perpetuate the conversation and to perpetuate the oppression of black and brown and poor people. And until we reconcile and disrupt that system and that ideology, we are not we're going to still be having the same issues. Just yesterday, there was congressional hearings on reparations.
Yeah.
And someone sent and posted a snapshot of, and I don't think, you know, I think that we have to stay open to all parties, right? But when we looked at one side of the aisle of Congress, most folks didn't even show up to listen or engage in this discussion. Yeah. And so power and wealth is not easily, people think that, you know, in order for you to win, I have to lose, right? And I just think that that's just the equation and the way the system has been designed in the United States. And, right, and you know, a couple of summers ago, right, so the summer of 2016, even then, up until that point, I lived and cling to this sense of idealism that in my lifetime, things would change in this country. And I remember within a week, there was the murder of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, by police, caught on videotape. A week later, Philando Castile outside of Minneapolis caught on a Facebook Live. He was murdered, right? Legally carrying firearms, right? And I had to force myself to say, you know what, Sean? Racism is not going to end in your lifetime, right? This summer, we are celebrating in Hampton Beach 400 years since first enslaved Africans were thrown to the shores, right? So here we are 400 years in. And yes, on one hand, there has been progress, but at the end of the day, black and brown people are still oppressed. And me coming to this realization, you know what? It's not going to end in your lifetime. On one way, it was disheartening. In another way, it was a relief and permission for me to, like, you know what, do what you can while you are here, pour into leaders, leave a legacy, and that you are part of a chain and link and a lineage of amazing ancestral lineage that do what you can while you are here, right? And so that's what I've committed my life to. Yeah. And that's why I lead the campaign for a Black Male Achievement. And it is really based in just the premise that there is nothing wrong with black men and boys in this country. It's the systems and the structures, and that so much of our work is about shifting the narrative and focusing on the assets and potential and possibilities of black men and boys and the black community. And that being able to, and this is why I like just, you know, being on this podcast and so much of the work that we've done over the years has been investing in film and investing in podcasts and arts and culture and being able to, what I like to say, become masters of our own media and tell our own stories, right? That there is another side than what is projected in mainstream media. And look, When They See Us, right, by Ava DuVernay is a classic example of the power of media and our ability to have platforms to tell our own stories.
Well, you're speaking my language. There's part of the reason I do what I do. Yeah, I think that, you know, it's fitting you brought up Ava DuVernay and when they See Us. So, you know, we're talking about the idea of being marginalized. So what I wonder is for how different that situation would be, you know, for a group of people who aren't marginalized, like how much of being marginalized is what put those kids in that situation to have them end up in the situation they did.
So I don't know if marginalized is the proper context and framing, right? Yeah. I think that when we look at race and the fact that these were five black boys, and when we look at the victim, a white woman, there is a long history in this nation, right, of black people and black men being railroaded and falsely accused. And so marginalization has something, yes, to do with it, right? But I do think that the fact of race and that these were five black boys and would they have been treated the same way if they were five white boys, right? Mm-hmm. I would venture to say no. You may have seen just this last week in Phoenix, uh-huh, Arizona, and, you know, I want to give a shout out to the bravery of folks that are able to, in the face of danger, pull out their phones and capture videotape of these injustices. But you may have seen when the police with weapons drawn, with a report that a four-year-old took a doll out of a dollar store, and how they assaulted and came up with guns drawn, a woman with a baby in her hand and pregnant. And would that have been done if they were not black? Maybe, but I doubt it, right? And I'm not going to say that that does not happen, but I just think that the humanity of black people in the United States, and there's a widespread ideology that we are less deserving, that we are threats, and that we don't have a right and we can be treated any other way, which is absolutely a lie, because we have a long history of liberation fighters, right, that say, no, you can't treat us any other way. And the When They See Us chronicles that story, right? And yes, there are other factors of poverty and legal representation, being able to if you have and can afford the best lawyers, right, that you know, wealth has a impact. But at the end of the day, I think it was less about them being marginalized and being five black boys and a case that had to be solved.
So, yeah, I want to spend some time talking about the work that you do at the Campaign for Black Male Achievement. You know, I had a chance to look through your website, and I guess really what I want to look at is maybe particularly look at a story of somebody who's come to you and kind of the impact, and which I'm guessing you probably have dozens, probably to the point where we should probably have one of them as a guest on the show. But I wonder, you know, could you walk us through an example of you know, one of these youths that comes to you and kind of, you know, maybe somebody who was headed down a wrong path and you know, how you help them course correct?
Sure. And I think it's important to note that so the Campaign for Black Male Achievement, we were launched at the Open Society Foundations, which is the philanthropy of George Soros, back in 2008. And we were originally supposed to be a 3-year campaign to improve the life outcomes of Black men and boys. And what's interesting to know, too often in philanthropy, we look at generational and centuries-long issues and say we're going to solve this problem in a 3 or 5 year grant making cycle. And the mere fact that we've been around for 11 years is a testament to so many folks' spirit of entrepreneurialism, persistence, relationships. And so we started off as a grant making entity, and over the last 11 years have funded and supported and helped to launch strategies across the country. We've invested close to $250 million dollars, right? And CBMA, our focus is really on the leaders and the organizations that are working to improve life outcomes of Black men and boys. And that's men and women. It's multi-gender, multi-race, and folks think of the Campaign for Black Male Achievement. We have over 8,000 individual members, and half of them are women, right? And so there is, I think of someone like a Willie Hamilton, who runs the United Black Men United in Omaha, Nebraska. And, you know, we all have this sense of, you know, a need for belonging. And Willie, 8 years ago, said to me when we were in the foundation, look, I don't want to necessarily get a grant from you. It would be great. I just want to be a part of the Campaign for Black Male Achievement. And by him coming to one of our events, you know, we do an annual gathering at the Muhammad Ali Center called Rumble, Young Man Rumble. And he represented his city. And he was connected at this convening with 150 other leaders from across the country. And he realized that, you know what, I am not fighting this fight alone. Like, I'm not building and battling alone. You know, one of my mission mantras is that God gave us two hands for a reason, so that we can build and battle at the same time. And so much of this social justice, racial justice work, we got to do both. We got to build and we have to battle. And he returned back to Omaha and declared that, you know, he was part of the Campaign for Black Male Achievement and with his organization, and began to get others in his city engaged. And so there was this ripple effect, right? And so while it's a national movement, the change really happens locally, right? It happens in places. And we say that, you know, your promise of place, which is our place-based strategy, is wherever you decide to take a stand. And there are so many leaders like Willie Hamilton and the young people that they work with across the country that are exposed to this national movement, and that they are the next wave of or the current wave of social justice leaders. You know, one of the things that brings me joy, we have an opportunity to bring folks across the country to our convenings and our gatherings, and to see a young man like Ernest, right? Ernest Butts, who is a fellow at the Campaign for Black Male Achievement. He was never in a plane. You know, he never flew before. And 2 years ago was his first flight going to Louisville, Kentucky for the Rumble Young Man Rumble. And it was kind of like the Roger Bannister mile, right? Once he broke that 4-minute mile, and he had that exposure. He's in Puerto Rico this summer and organizing and supporting folks that are still recovering from the hurricane. And he did some traveling last year. And so much of this work, I like to, and so much of my mission, it's about you know, it's like midwifery, right? And being able to pull out of individuals what they can't push out on their own, right? And I tell this story. I have four children, and I was there for the delivery of all four of my children. And my final born child, I had twin boys, Cameron and Caleb. And Caleb, in the delivery room, his twin brother came out, Cameron. And no matter how hard my wife, Desiree, pushed, Caleb would not come out. I was like, what's happening? She's already pushed out four babies in her lifetime. And Caleb was breached. He was turned around. You know, babies come out head first, and they weren't ready for a C-section. And 9 minutes after his twin brother Cameron was born, Caleb's vital signs were beginning to drop. And the doctor said, I have to go in and pull him out, right? And pulled Caleb out by his feet. And so many of us leaders who have pushed out great things, but the thing that we are called to really push out that is going to make a transformational impact in the world, we will never push out alone. We need to get vulnerable and be able to say, as leaders, and particularly when we're looking at Black men, to be able to go to another man and say, or woman, and say, I have something inside of me and I need your help to pull it out. And I'm grateful that I've grown up in a generation where I've seen a shift around masculinity and gender norms. My father and grandfather, to cry was a sign of weakness, right? To be vulnerable was a sign of weakness, and to be afraid and to let somebody know that you were afraid was a death sentence in some cases. And we are, with the Campaign for Black Male Achievement and so many of our partner organizations, are in a space now where this whole notion of addressing toxic masculinity and patriarchy is something that is acceptable and necessary in our community. And one of our members is a guy named Jason Wilson out of Detroit, who has a best-selling book. We just told his story. He'd be a great guest. It's called Cry Like a Man. Mm. And just really demystifying this whole notion of emotional sturdiness and not being able to share emotions. And Srini, I tell the leaders that I'm associated with, if you are not engaged with a mentor, an executive coach, and a therapist, you are at a disadvantage, right? And this whole notion of addressing and pulling the covers off of mental health in our community, I'm just seeing so much more momentum over the years around this, because to be Black in America, as James Baldwin said, and I'm paraphrasing, is almost to be in a constant state of rage, you know, a constant state of rage. And so we need to be champions and be able to share our vulnerability as Black men, and to say, you know what, it is okay. You know what? You don't tell a 8-year-old boy, don't cry and act like a man. He's 8 years old. He's supposed to cry. It's okay to cry. And so what I'm seeing just across the country, with so many of my peers and the next generation, that it is okay to be emotionally vulnerable. And part of our work, we launched 3-4 years ago, BMA Health and Healing Strategies, when we are addressing the health, healing, and wellness of the leaders. So many of our leaders came to us and said, I am depressed. I am stressed out. I have been thinking about suicide. And we said, wow, This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders that we are investing in to do the work. If they are traumatized, how are we going to win? And so we have just seen so many investors over the last few years say, you know what, this issue of healing and wellness is important. There's a Dr. Sean Jenright in San Francisco that has really been crusading this notion of healing-centered communities and schools. And so, I'm encouraged. I often, when I look at the condition and the state and where we stand as Black people in this nation, I often say it's the paradox of promise and peril, because there is both a peril. It is still perilous in this nation for a Black man. But I also see so much promise. And I know that you've done a lot of work around, you know, where you put your attention, right? And where you put your focus, right? Not that we ignore the peril, not that we ignore the liabilities, but we focus on the promise and the assets, because I firmly believe that what we focus on grows, and we have to tell that story of promise and love and how we lead. And if we don't tell that story, somebody's going to tell the story for us.
Amazing. Well, this has been really, really just a treat and eye-opening, thought-provoking. One of those conversations that I think really makes us think and hopefully brings about, you know, the start of a conversation for a lot of people that I think is much needed. I want to finish with my final question, which I know you've heard me ask as a longtime listener of the show, and that is, what do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Well, you know, I knew you were going to ask me that question too, right? But so, what makes you unmistakable is that a few things. That when you die, your eulogy is such of how you lived your life, what you represented, and the values, that someone hears your eulogy and your eulogy becomes their life's epilogue. And I think that being unmistakable is that we are called to do things that if they are not done through you and by you, they won't be done at all. And that there are things that people look to and people hear and they say, that is distinctly Sean Dove. That is Sean Dove's a fingerprint, and that no one else could have done that except for him.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and sharing your story and your insights on all of the work that you're up to with our listeners. Where can people find out more about what you're up to? And also, are there any requests that you have for our audience that they can help with, you know, in terms of your own efforts?
Sure. So I can be reached at, go to my website, blackmaleachievement.org. I personally can be reached at sdove@blackmaleachievement.org. That is my email address, and I am on Twitter, and I am on Instagram. And I believe that this is not when we talk about Black male achievement, Black America's journey. Right. This is America's journey. Right. And so there is something that everybody can do, no matter gender or race. And I would ask folks to go to our website and become a member and join the campaign for Black Male Achievement. There are ways that you can devote your time, your talent, and your treasure as an ally and a supporter and a member in the movement.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.